Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel Noise, episode 266. Your usual host, David A. Price, is off having a peak experience at C2E2. So I'm Steve Raker, filling in from my post at the Comic Book Bunker. You can find past episodes and new episodes on marvelnoise.com, and you can visit and like our Facebook page or communicate with the show via Twitter at Marvel Noise. This episode features the guys, Kevin Whirlwind X, Andrew the LA Rabbit, and myself, covering the conclusion to the classic Thunderbolts title, as we knew it, issues 73 through 75. This is before the new editorial office changed everything about the book but its title. You can also hear the three of us and Phil, or various combinations thereof, over on our sister's show, Indie Comic Book Noise, where we discuss our recent indie reads without the constraints of being a family-friendly podcast as this is. Before we get our Thunderbolts on, I want to catch you up on, as I do from time to time on past episodes, on what's happening with Marvel's Digital Infinite Comic Initiative. As I've said before, these are likely to fall under or past the radar of many seasoned readers' attentions, or just those readers that don't often read digital or know what's going on in with those books, or see that certain ones are just movie tie-in type things and aren't interested, or for younger readers. But now dozens and dozens of the past Infinite comics that I've discussed on previous episodes are available on the Marvel Unlimited digital subscription service site app thing. Remember, I really liked the Deadpool Gauntlet, the Iron Man Frontier something, maybe, and the Daredevil ones. Fighting the Adaptoid, that was cool. Check them out. So here's what's what of the current Digital Infinite Comic offerings. There are currently 8 running. The first is from the Marvel Universe. Actually, the first 3 are from the Marvel Universe line that is all ages, more of related to the cartoon shows and of that nature. The first is Avengers Assemble, Infinite Power, issues number 1 through 5. This is the cast of the TV show with the sensibilities of the TV show, written by Kevin Burke and Doc Wyatt, with masked layouts and Mario Del Penio and Roberto Poggi art. Remember, these Infinite comics, they usually have either Mast or Jeffo doing the layout storyboarding that are unique to how they pace and put together and construct these Infinite comics. The art here, it's a little too manga-ish for me, and it isn't even that manga-ish, but here we have Arsenal, who is Tony's robot friend nemesis from the show, and the Infinity Stones, and they're facing a team of dark versions of themselves, and it's all well and good. There's also Marvel Universe Guardians of the Galaxy, which is also has the sensibilities of their TV show. The art is intended to be appealing to younger readers here. It's 8 issues into an arc where the team is sucked into Rocket's pocket dimension storage vial, which is courtesy of the collector, where Rocket keeps all of his hardware and his ordnance and stuff. And there they encounter a prisoned Pokemon-looking being who leads them on a crazy chase through, like, M.C. Escher-like staircases and other crazy, impossible architecture, and eventually escapes the storage vial by possessing Drax and escaping with the team. This story is still ongoing, so we'll see where it goes in upcoming installments. It's written by Marguerite Scott, with Jeffo and Mast storyboards, and Luciano Vecchio art. The third Marvel Universe title is Marvel Universe Ultimate Spider-Man, and I've discussed that before. We're already up to issue 20. This is issues 20 through 24. It's the 5-part Rival Schools, written by Tim Seeley, with layouts by Mastin Jeffo again and art again by Luciano Vecchio. It's just like the show with S.H.I.E.L.D., Nova, the White Tiger, Power Man, and Iron Fist. The Midtown High School mascot, Molly the Mustang, is stolen before a big game. Oh no! So, our gang goes undercover to infiltrate a rival school and face lots of fighting training robots along the way in the S.H.I.E.L.D. sequence. But then they have to take out and deal with a new group of super adversaries that mirror themselves. There's the Iraq Kid, or the Black Bunny, you know, etc. Another title that is set this time in the Marvel Cinematic Universe is a one-shot tying into the upcoming movie. It's Marvel's Captain America Civil War Prelude Infinite Comic. This is written by Will Corona Pilgrim with art by Lee Ferguson, Gordon Sadzuka, and Guillermo Mogoron. And puts Cap the Falcon, the Winter Soldier, and Brock Rumlow in place for where they need to be for the movie. And it shows Cap getting intel on Rumlow becoming Crossbones, and we even get a glimpse of his uniform all before the movie. It's interesting. It's there's so many artists because each of the characters is drawn in a sequence told by a different artist, and you're kind of looking into the headspace of that character. Also, we have Amazing Spider-Man and Silk, the Spider-Fly effect. This is a 5 issues so far of this ongoing tale, and it is written by Robbie Thompson with storyboards by Jeffo, and art by Tom Grummet and Wayne Foucher. We have Spidey and Silk encountering a rogue Hydra agent in a stolen dinosaur suit with time-traveling capabilities. I'm not even going to repeat that. I can't believe I just put that sentence together. But they lose their powers in the time travel, but meet up with a pre-mortem Uncle Ben who helps them get their, at least, heroic mojo back. Peter doesn't reveal his identity to Ben, though. So then they've got to find the guy with the suit in that time without their powers and try to get him to somehow help them return home. But did I mention Tom Grummet art? So it's got that going for it. Because, I mean, even though I'm pretty tired of Uncle Ben stories, but I gotta admit, the dialogue between Peter and Uncle Ben is admittedly cute as Peter's dancing around what he and the readers all know. And then there's this thing where Cindy, Silk, she wants to warn her parents and alter history, not put her in the bunker. So there's that going on. Oh, and Uncle Ben is in on the whole caper so far as if he's like part of the A-team or something. Another book, Infinite Comic, is Daredevil Punisher, Seventh Circle. Hey, why pair these two together right now, I wonder? This has 2 issues out so far. It's written by Charles Soule, with layouts by Riley Brown, and pencils and inks by Simon Kudransky. And this is current continuity. It's contemporary Daredevil with the gray uniform and the red highlights and everything. Matt has a gangster's trial moved to Texas so that he can get a fair trial. but the Punisher attacks the prison transport along the way. So it's up to Daredevil and his new protege Blindspot, ! To make sure the accused gets justice and not just punishment. As I said, that one's still ongoing. Then we have this new thing going on. It's a year of Marvels. And Marvel's thinking of it being like, kind of like the old Kurt Busiek, Alex Ross Marvels, but it's not connected to that at all. What this is going to be a monthly set of Infinite Comic one-shots spotlighting different characters. And so far, the ones that came out for February and March, issues 1 and 2, are great so far. So I'm actually really liking this one. And if you want to check out an Infinite Comic here or there, I think this is where to go. The one for February, the first issue, is Spidey versus the Vulture. And it's a nice action-packed story. Old-school romp with some Valentine's overtones since it's February. But there's texting and stuff. It's not set in the past, but it has the sensibilities of kind of an old Spidey tale. Written by Ryan North, with masked layouts, and Danilo Bayrouth providing really cool art. I dug this one. The second issue for March is written by Amy Chu, with Riley Brown layouts and Ryan Brown art, and it is Spring Break, Ant-Man and Grizzly style. Enough said. The last Infinite comic I want to mention is Deadpool and Cable, Split Second. This is a six-issue series that just wrapped up, with plot, script, and pencils from Fabian Nicieza and Riley Brown, with inks by Jay Leistein and Jeremy Freeman. This is a time travel caper, folks, which plays well in the Infinite comic format, with repeating panels, with taps where just various different things change, but other things don't, and the scenes can be presented. It's a different way to show movement, and especially people teleporting into a panel, and teleporting out, and teleporting into another place in the panel, as the sort of position of the characters stays the same. Otherwise, it's done well with the Infinite comic vehicle. Here we have a scientist who's developing a time travel suit, and he tragically loses his son to a stray bullet in a downtown melee between Cable, Deadpool, and this guy in a suit of chrono armor. You seeing the irony here? It was Deadpool's gun, but the guy in the chrono armor pulled the trigger accidentally. That's not how it's supposed to go down, so the chrono-armored dude goes back in time to fix things. But this time, Deadpool accidentally slices the head off a teen who's riding a bike and it's with his sword as he's on the backswing. Whoops! So the chrono-armored dude goes back in time to fix things again, but this time a baby in a carriage gets killed. So he goes back to fix things again. You get the idea, right? One time, Deadpool even gives a kid... They think it's going well, but Deadpool, in their victory, gives a kid like a peanut butter bar, and the kid's allergic to peanuts and dies on the side. So they gotta repeat and try again. So after a few issues that, then we have Deadpool has to travel to Cable's future, because Cable's getting all messed up by this time traveling repeated stuff, and there's this whole Cable's future problem with Ascani Sun continuity, and, you know, Tetherblood and Blacksmith with the Q and all that. There's even a Mark Gruenwald cameo, thanks to the Time Variance Authority making its presence known and sharing information with Deadpool. But the whole adventure is honestly action-packed and ultimately restores Cable to a familiar status quo and cleans up his continuity some, which the goals were of this tale, admitted through the tale itself. And I gotta say, like all the Deadpool-related Infinite comics, this is a good one. Check this one out.
Cross the rainbow bridge of Asgard, where the booming heavens roar. You'll behold in breathless wonder the God of Thunder, Mighty Thor.
I also just recently reread the Thor Godstorm three-issue limited series from the end of 2001, each issue being 32 pages of story, priced at $350, prestige-type format, $525 in Canada. Sorry, Kevin and Phil and our other friends up north. It is written by Kurt Busiek, with pencils by Steve Rude and inks by Mike Royer, doing their Kirby vibe, with Steve Rude painted covers. And this is a great three-issue, or books, I should say, series. The opening part is a framing sequence with two Viking youths, Ullr and Wilf, who uncannily resemble a youthful Thor and Loki, living among the coast of the North Sea, amongst their Viking tribe in 912 AD. And they encounter an elder donned in leather, wielding a staff with a beard-mustache combo that resembles Odin. And the elder proceeds to tell them the story of how their tribal chief's stone pendant came from, where it originates from. And we get a 12-page Thor tale in the style of an early Lee Kirby era Thor story. And this is the tale of the mighty Thor and the storm that rebelled. Here, Loki travels to Cragmouth, the forbidden dwelling of the storms when they don't rage in our skies. And despite the Godstorm citing Thor as a patron, that they, the storms, serve with great pride, Loki makes the case that Thor cares nothing for the storms and treats them as mere slaves, using the example of Thor recently manipulating a storm to allow Frigga to picnic under sunshine. As an example, I mean, the injustice of it, you know, for a whim. Then we cut to the ancestors of the Vikings of the North Coast heading out in their sea vessels to fend off a larger fleet of invading berserkers who seek to slaughter them. Now, Thor takes note of this, and although he's not asked for his aid, he decides to lend it anyway to his worshippers on Midgard and calls upon a storm to support the underdog Vikings' cause. Loki takes this as a golden opportunity to further manipulate the storm, the God Storm, against Thor. Destroy him, obey him no longer. Look, he's forcing you into his servitude again. And the storm obeys and rebels. And Thor, he's separated from Mjolnir for a while and tossed around in the air. And there's Vikings strewn about and into the sea to their deaths, and vessels being crashed with lightning and, you know, big surf and all that business. It's pretty intense until Thor retrieves and then calls upon the powers of his hammer and his heritage and overpowers the Godstorm, commanding it against the invading horde. And then he tells it to goest to the sea floor and below, down to the rock of the earth, where it wilt be trapped forever. And in the aftermath and the victory celebration, Thor notices a chunk of Mjolnir has been shattered, and it's kind of breaking off, and he takes the little chunk and gives it to the Viking chieftain as a reward for his bravery and to cement their lineage of leadership. Then we cut to a two-page interlude with the elder wise men using rune sticks to now see into the future to answer the question of whether the storm ever reappeared. He says it hasn't yet when the kids ask him, but in the future, twice more will a thunder god face the God Storm. And that leads us into a 13-page tale told in the style of an early Lee Kirby issue of The Avengers. It's the tale of the mighty Thor and the man who made weather. The Avengers battle this cat, the Weathermaker, who is armored, and he has all kinds of weather-related Kirby-ish weaponry. And he has a hostage, Maureen, who says she hates him and will never forgive him, and he's like arguing with her while he's fighting off the Avengers. In the melee, though, the Weathermaker accidentally topples rubble onto her, and she's gravely injured, and he's captured. Thor, as this is all going on, is told to return to Asgard, or else by floating head Odin, because the trolls are amassing for an attack on Asgard. But Thor has to help take down the weather guy, which he does, and now he has to rush Maureen to get urgent medical care in Dr. Don Blake's office. Well, Odin gets so upset, he relieves Thor of his Midgard duties and spirits him back to Asgard for good this time, he says. The end of this issue, book one, shows the incarcerated Weathermaker dude using circuitry that he's got in a false tooth to call to his cell a violent storm, or the power of a violent storm, to free him. Guess which power he gets? That's right. So, the God Storm has some of his power taken, and he gladly, it's almost as if he's not in prison, because this mortal that's freed him will become his vessel. And the Godstorm actually seems to be merging its power with this guy in a panel full of all Kirby-ish crackle. And the book one, closes with a one-page scene of the Viking youths begging the storyteller elder to tell them more. But the old man points out that the skies grow dark, it's getting late, and that good Viking children need their sleep, and he promises to finish the tale anon. The second book opens with the 23-page epic tale, The Tale of the Mighty Thor and the Challenge of Torrent. While Thor and his Asgardian brethren are preparing for the advancing troll army in Asgard, on Midgard, a nearly nuclo-looking energy being calling himself Torrent, he's imbued with the power of the storm and its eternal rage, not file sharing. This Torrent fellow is going on a rampage and trashing metropolitan New York. Loki notices from Asgard that, yes, it's the Godstorm, having not really been freed, but his power is used to imbue this mortal. And, this Weathermaker guy now has escaped from prison and is causing this rampage. So Loki tells Odin about how Midgard is periled by a disaster of Thor's own making. And he says all this right in front of Thor, saying that Thor is going to be compromised knowing that all this is happening. And Odin's like, well, Loki wouldn't even have known if you didn't come up and tell us this. But that's besides the point. Yes, Thor, you probably are compromised, right? Make a choice. And Thor, of course, has to go help. And he makes a deal with Odin to return to Midgard to deal with Torrent, and that he will return by nightfall to help Asgard against the trolls. If he doesn't return by nightfall, he's banished forever, and Loki becomes Asgard's favored prince. Yes, Loki's thinking of his Don Blake persona, because Dr. Blake asked Nurse Jane, who at this time doesn't know that he and Thor are the same, he asked Jane to go find that Maureen girl that the Weathermaker first appeared with, who was injured. And she brings her to the battle scene after we hear all about his origin story and everything, and it distracts Torrent at a key moment for Thor to use Mjolnir's, space-warping ability to transport them to Asgard right into the... Thor was late. It's in a battle when Odin was thinking that Thor had forsaken them. It was all very 60s in every way. It's a really fun tale with a lot more details and story beats than I'm going to take the time to share, because I want you to read it. Then we get a 2-page cutaway scene that advances the framing sequence with the Elder Woodsman storyteller using magic runestones to see further into the future to Thor's third encounter with the Godstorm. It's the tale of the mighty Thor and the long-imprisoned Storm. Here on the back 9 of book 2, we get just 6 pages of setup. The story is taking place in then-current modern Thor continuity during the early Dan Jurgens written era, which itself was somewhat retro at times. But here we have medic Jake Olsen as Thor's human to body swap with. And we're introduced to Brom, who's like the head worker on an oil rig out in the middle of the sea, who happens to be a descendant of the Vikings of the North Shore. And he wears the rock pendant heirloom of his ancestors, not really knowing that it's a chunk of Mjolnir. Anyway, the oil rig is drilling deep into the ocean floor for oil, and they instead tap into the trapped Godstorm. He starts rumbling, percolating like coffee. He's coming. And that's the perfect time for a 2-page closing sequence with the Elder teasing the Viking youths and the readers to come back for what happens next. The third issue, book 3, has 5 pages of the framing sequence as bookends, with a 27-page finale in between. The tale of the mighty Thor and the promise that was kept. And again, as I'd like you to go and find and read, or if you have these books in your long boxes, dig them out and reread them, I'm purposely being more vague about details and story beats as we go on. But I want you to get the idea of the revisitations of the encounters with this Godstorm and all of its manifestations, and really, I want to praise the mastery of the creative team involved here, because these are fun stories. In this last book, book 3, the accidentally freed Godstorm escapes his ocean bed prison with a bang, crippling and nearly destroying the oil rig, its crew in dire peril. It's an enormous disaster. The Godstorm takes on a giant-sized humanoid form and ferociously battles Thor when he arrives on scene. Brom, who's the Viking descendant oil rig worker guy, has a whole human level of concern family story that's going on too, that's quite good, but his main role is to over and over again here now act heroically to rescue his men and to get them to safety. Loki also makes his grand move, centuries in the making in fact, by usurping the power of the Godstorm, taking it himself and becoming a giant being and just beating the snot out of Thor until he ultimately finds a way out of this predicament and to beat Loki and to bring the storm's rage against him to a final end. Honestly, it's truly epic, and it closes with the epic storyteller happily walking off into the woods, satisfied that the imaginations and the aspirations of the Viking youths have been, you know, promoted and supported. They're going to now thrive and lead their clan to, you know, prosperous adventures. And he's solidified the Viking tribe's viability and durability by telling the stories to the next generation, basically. And he then, as we all expected him to do, transforms into Odin and walks up an arc of the Rainbow Bridge back to Asgard, stating that his worshippers need a little subtle support now and again to preserve the future by learning of their customs and the history and all that. A good story all around, both all of the little interlude stories that became grander as the issues, the books, went on, but also the framing sequence was fun and had its little touch of appreciation of mythology and handing down traditions and the value of stories, etc. The way that Busick used the framing sequences here successfully, it reminded me of what he would do not long after this, with his use of the framing sequence in his Conan book for Dark Horse. All right, that's it from me, solo at least. Wait no longer. Bring on the T-Bolts.
I read 73 twice.
But then didn't read 74 or 5?
Yeah.
Oh, that would have been funny.
Welcome back, Marvel Noise listeners. Here we are with Marvel's Most Wanted, Justice Like Lightning. We're going to bolt some thunder. I guess that one doesn't really work. It's the Marvel Noise famous Thunderbolt segment with me, Andrew, a relatively first-time Thunderbolts reader, shepherded carefully by the Thunderbolts guru, head of the Tumblr Bolts himself, WWX Kev Whirlwind. Say hi, Kev.
I like how you mentioned the Tumblr there.
Oh, yes. It's a must. The comics are a visual medium. It's always good to have pictures to go with our words. And lastly, because otherwise we would never finish, we have Super Steve dialing in from the bunker, who is himself a on and off again Thunderbolts man.
Yeah, time and time again, I keep trying to bolt some thunder. But I'll keep trying. I'm going to keep trying.
The conceit of this is a complete reread of the classic, original Thunderbolts, right from birthed in the last millennia. And now we are up to the important anniversary issue of number 75. This episode will cover issues 73 through 75, double-sized in all its glory. But Kev, why don't you tell us who's on the team?
Before you get into it, with the last few installments of this Thunderbolts that we've been doing, the issues broke up into two divergent teams and storylines, and one ran in the odd numbers and one ran in the even numbers, and we're finally getting to the last issue of each of those teams' adventures so that they can combine into a artistic quilt of an issue 75 anniversary issue.
So our long form lineup then for the Thunderbolts. Our Thunderbolts on Counter-Earth are Baron Zemo, leader man with a plan. Carla is Moonstone, manipulator woman with two Moonstone gems. Eric in Dallas, who I looked in the recap page, is called Atlas. So that's kind of weird. Two people using the same body with the bubblegum ionic form. We call them bubblegum at least. Abe is Mach 3 or Mach 5. I don't know what happened to 4. He flies with a tech armor suit. Norbert is the fixer. He fixes things with his smarts. Haley is Jolt. Does stuff with bioelectricity. Now our Thunderbolts on Earth. Melissa is Songbird, almost a leader with her sound. Clint is Hawkeye, ex-Avenger, with a threatening bow and arrow. Plant Man is Blackheath, Manplant, with plants. Cardinal is Harrier, gunning for Hawkeye, with his tech armor suit. Gypsy Moth is Skin, I think. However you pronounce that, Andrew. Controls Fabric, with her powers. Amazon is Mankiller, strong, with being basically a female version of an Eric. Cyclone is... Cyclone? Using wind with his copying whirlwind abilities.
And bad accent.
Yeah, that too.
Another great cover on 73 from Juan Bobillo. I think it's a pretty striking pose of Mankiller there, Amazon.
Yeah, it's weird. I don't remember him doing these covers back in the day, but he probably wasn't anyone that sought out or anything.
I mean, her character doesn't have a very cool-looking design. It's so sort of a riff off of the old Atlas armor, but here it looks cool.
It seems to marry the headgear. It reminded me a little bit of Hercules as well.
Sure.
The sort of brace. But we're on, because it's 73, we're looking, well, Fabian, I'm going to skip pronouncing his last name.
Nisienza.
I saw the... his speech at Long Beach Expo, and he went on about how everyone butchers his name.
Oh, all right, then Fabian it is.
Manuel Garcia on pencils, Scott Hanna inks, Hi-Fi Design colors, and RS and Comic Craft letters, Richard Starking. So we're back, and there's the previously recap, but as Steve politely mentioned, we're doing that split storyline that's going to merge together. So currently we have Citizen V staring at Hawkeye and the illegal Thunderbolts and Robot Dum Dum Dugan.
The Bachelors of Evil Thunderbolts?
Yes.
He's doing the Joe Quesada cap pooping pose.
Oh, jeez.
It does seem slightly unfortunate, I would say.
Yeah. And he's trying to sell Hawkeye and the Bolts here on saving the world one more time, but... yeah, he's going to have to do a heavy sell job since Hawkeye doesn't seem to be buying it here. It's always a Thunderbolts transition, though. As soon as you finish one adventure, you're sent off to another world or some other world-saving thing, and somehow you still get your character or downtime in.
Because did we see this crisis developing, or we're really hearing about it here for the first time as the team is from Citizen V? Because this is kind of big.
It is. Yeah. I think we are, but... Once we realize what it is, then we'll be like, oh, that's what it... We haven't linked it with our other storyline yet. But, at least but, I haven't. Well, but this I mean, you the, do because you're reading them.
This is the first we're hearing that the way cool big giant fortress ship that the V Battalion uses is, like, you know, in trouble. And it's, like, imploding into a white hole or something, right?
Yeah. You know what's terrible about Dum Dum Dugan here, too? Again, he's all harping on the Thunderbolts, like, oh, I don't believe you can do it.
What was funny is we had all forgotten about Silver Sable. So I think Kevin hinted that she just shows up and says, hey, you forgot about me, but I let myself out.
Sure. Yeah, I'm just over here. Forgotten plot point. Yeah, I'll just let myself out.
But important that she shows up with the cloak that then they need to use the Red Hood's cloak. Crimson, well, Scarlet Centurion, Crimson Cowl.
Yeah, at least they remember to put Crimson Cowl like somewhere. The Silver Sable thing, okay, maybe she can get out herself, but you want to make sure that Crimson Cowl is wrapped up and everything.
But not in her cloak.
Yeah.
What bothered me is this is on page one with it being issue 73, and I know 75 is coming up as a big anniversary issue. I'm looking at all of a sudden them saying that there's problems with the hyperdrive or whatever of the big V Battalion. I'm feeling like, oh my gosh, they're going to cut all their... They're going to, like, do Scorched Earth on everything Thunderbolts and wrap this title up. I'm worried that this is going to be the end of the V Battalion. Right away. So this whole story feeling like, oh man, are they going to get rid of the V Battalion? Here's their we've been talking for all these past episodes. We've done side limited series and stuff and saying like, this is an untapped potential here with a lot of interesting story stuff going on and connections to other aspects of the Marvel Universe. And now I'm feeling like, oh man, are they going to just totally wipe the slate clean here just because they're in a new editorial office?
Do you trust Fabian, Steve?
Yeah, but I'm afraid he's not going to be. I'm afraid of the new editors. We'll see. I'm progressing cautiously.
Well, I'm not quite as nervous, only because I bought a whole bunch of these comics, so I know that it's tough sometimes to separate that out, knowing it's just going to be that. But yes, I see. Like I said, the Silver Sable thing just made me, because I had actually kind of forgotten she was in it too.
Yeah.
And I was reading these things in pretty close succession, so.
It's like when Richard Dreyfuss pops up at the end of Jaws and you're like, oh yeah, he went behind the coral. You forget all about it.
So you think the editors or the writer or someone like forgot about that, or it was just supposed to be that way? Because it's funny that you read them fast and even you forget. You like get involved in the story and you're like, oh yeah, Silver Sable.
I think it's because I
forgot, and it feels that it does feel. I mean, I think that's why she makes the joke, because it does feel a little tacked on.
But you know who I don't think who would approve of the Heroes for Hire is Hawkeye, because Silver Sable's here trying. You know, she's fine. She'll be like, oh, she'll pay off Cyclone if he wants to do it for the money, this whole mission. But Hawkeye's not having it. And I'm all like, whoa, whoa, isn't that what the Heroes for Hire do? They help people for money?
Well, not just that, but then he ends up blackmailing Cyclone and saying, you either help or you go to prison. And I'm like, well, why not let him get paid? Like, clearly he's not doing it for any kind of moral reason.
I'm feeling
it seemed like a weird...
I think Hawkeye's line is that he doesn't want villains, former villains, who need to truly demonstrate that they're doing things for the right reason before they can, you know, personally gain in this way. He doesn't want them to be tempted. They're too close to being on the dark side. So to have it be, yeah, well, all right, well, we'll fight on the side of the angels, but, you know, for money, that's not the challenge that he wants to put in front of this team. He does challenge them, and certainly Cyclone fails big time. Au revoir.
Hawkeye gets to pull out the bow and arrow and put it in Cyclone's face again.
Yeah, because you can't go more than four issues without that. But it just seems like one of those, I mean, how can you trust your blackmailing him into it? Seems like that could create as many problems,
sure,
as just having him in. You know what I mean? Is paying him, at least paying him, he wants to be there. Now, you know, if the second he gets a chance, you only got him there via threat.
Well, that's the fun of a later run of the Thunderbolts a few years down the line, when they've actually, Luke Cage is the warden, if you will, of a group of Thunderbolts, and they really don't want to be there, and he is looking after them to double-cross or try to run away at any given time, and it puts a nice twist and some interesting intrigue into the storyline that's extra despite, you know, in spite of whatever mission they're on. Little drama.
Well, here we have them heading, so they're going to head into the Vanguard ship, which means that they're going to save the art team a lot of help by whiting out large sections of panels.
Yeah.
I'm not super thrilled. I mean, I understand it adds somewhat to the effect, but I don't know. It just felt, some of these newer effects, like the blurring of images and stuff, I don't know. It's supposed to increase the storytelling, but it takes me out some of the time.
Yeah. Just draw in the blinds or the, like, somehow, yeah, white it out somehow. Or I guess I always think of the thing, too, when characters used to jump from rooftop to rooftop, and then you would draw in all, like, the little figures in the trail, and I'm like, oh, yeah.
I think it was overused as a stunt tool for a while. I don't think it's done that much these days. I mean, I know just in the Secret Wars we had those white room type scenes, and I know that logistically it was done to help Ribic cut corners, but I felt like it was story-ish enough that I was able to tolerate it, because I don't see it as much as we used to.
Yeah.
I do agree with you. It just always kind of, it's that whole, it feels like they just have a new toy, so everyone wants to play with it sort of thing that doesn't, it can be story justified, but for me it always seems like, ugh, man, this again. But they're trying to, and they do work as a team a little bit, which is somewhat surprising, because Hawkeye has to go in and he has Amazon anchor him.
What? But I thought you don't go into the light. That's what I always heard, don't go into the light.
To go so he can rescue the most famous hero of all, as Kevin remarked earlier on social media.
What, Sanctuary?
Yeah. You were like, isn't he a household name by now?
Isn't he?
So Hawkeye saves him, which is important because part of his backstory is that the Red Hood recruited him by through some logic I don't understand. She was able to blame Hawkeye for the death.
You know, he comments on that later on, but I think Steve was justified in his worries earlier because it looks like they've lost half of the V Battalion. Uh-oh, deck clearing.
I mean, that's not cool.
Well, given their age, I think, you know, like, a strong shock will break all their hips to begin with, so...
This is elder abuse. This is elder abuse on the page.
So they have to split the different teams up. So that's another part of it. So they're going to see what they can do to sort of close the gap here. And then there's some nice blurring effects to go with all the whiting effects as well.
Oh, it's way overdone in this issue.
So, but everyone gets a chance to show their kind of strengths and weaknesses. And like I said, I was kind of surprised at how sort of team-buildy the whole thing was.
Yeah.
It almost kind of makes the villains on Hawkeye's team want to turn hero, you could say.
I think all villains want to. If Thunderbolts has taught us anything, it's that every villain really just wants to be a hero when you come right down to it.
Except for the Red Skull.
And Crossbones.
He wants to be Onslaught. That's because the Red Skull taught Crossbones.
That's right.
And his daughter, the junior Red Skull, and his cousin, and his uncle, and his third niece twice removed.
And maybe Bullseye doesn't want to play along either.
But other than that, we're pretty clear. Yeah. So basically, it's going to come down to one of those, oh no, you know, we're at the end, we're going to have to sacrifice ourselves. Amazon's going to have to be the anchor as the team goes in again.
And what's going to be on the other side of the void? Complain about the green?
Yes. The DC knockoff guy is going to help use his distinguished competition senses to help anchor them. And it ends on a cliffhanger, though. As they pull them through, and they're standing there, but off-panel, we see a gun pointed to Hawkeye's head.
No, I hope that, you know, links up with the last panel we see in 74, like...
Well, there's also then the real cliffhanger is the inside back cover splash of Tobacco is Wacko.
But, Andrew, only if you're a teen, it's Wacko.
Yes. For everyone else, it's just your own single life decision. So that leads us to 74, and again, we're having the fancy covers here. And this looks like a bubblegum charging through with a lot of white space. And my direct edition box has been disturbed by the force of him charging through.
Yeah, they're all character profiles again.
We're reaching that point, I think, where we're going to get to the cover not necessarily being linked to the contents, but this, because it's the other side, it's the Chris Batista, and now we have Rich Parada on inks. So it's, again, as we talked about before, that split art team. So this is our counter-Earth, Thunderbolts.
What's with Zemo smirking, like, this whole issue? He's just smiling and smirking, he's like, I'm cool.
Yeah, the Zemo, as I talked about before, his transformation seems uncharacteristic.
He just loves not having a scarred face.
Yep. Maybe that was it. The whole time it was just the scarred face. This is why he was such a jerk. Interesting. I had not encountered that hypothesis before. I like it, Kevin. I like it. But it's a Moonstone. Oh, remember, we had the character. What's happening on Counter-Earth is there's this horrible force, this void that's eating the inside of the planet out. And the last one ended with, for Counter-Earth to survive, the regular 616 Earth has to die. And Zemo's totally cool with that. So he's working with a character who was birthed in the Japan over there, who's this powerful kind of, basically sort of looks like Sunfire kind of from the Legion of Superheroes. He's like an energy being encased in armor.
That's a fair description.
Or Prodigy.
And so Zemo's talking about how they're going to, you know, restructure the void so it blows up the 616 Earth but saves them.
I like how Moonstone's like the first one to wake up because she has the double Moonstone. And then she sees what Zemo is doing, and then she's like, ugh, I don't really know which way is the right way to approach the situation. Like, I need someone to fight with. I need someone who's going to lecture me and tell me what the good and right thing to do is, so then I'll know, and then I'll say, oh, yeah, it was there all along. Of course that's what I'm supposed to do. So, of course, she finds Jolt, who has this, like, sort of, like, hilarious, cartoonish speech, and then Moonstone's like really interested, going, yeah, that's exactly what I want. And then she's like waving her, like she has her finger pointed at Moonstone, and she's like going back and forth. It's about the people. We can't let everyone die, and blah, blah, blah.
It's always about the people.
Yeah, so that dynamic has always been fun. But, so obviously Haley's not going to let, although I thought it was weird that, like, they just call her Jolt, but I guess she's mostly in her bubblegum form. So she convinces Moonstone that they're going to have to try and find some way to save the world. And we also have Counter-Earth hero group is still there. And that's Bucky, the female version, and the Bull Man.
Toro.
And the cosmic entity that only exists in Counter-Earth. It's getting to be a confusing cast.
Yep. The young allies of Counter-Earth.
Yeah.
But Moonstone's going to go, and she gets in Zemo's face about this because they have this other plan that will save both Earths, but it's unlikely to succeed. But she has to go convince the Baron, and the Baron throws in her face that, are you doing this all for Hawkeye? How are you gonna do it?
Yeah, isn't it great that Fixer says, sure, this plan's gonna work, guys, and it's not gonna work.
Well, who's he to rain on people's parades?
Yep, it's the new supportive Norbert.
The new human fleshy supportive Norbert, I guess.
Yes.
So, yeah, this is more the talky talk. The last one, the other issue was more the running around fighting the blurry screens and the cool, fun, blurry panels. This one is the talk about figuring it out. So the Young Allies have a telepathic character, and yeah, he hooks up
German
Zemo to, like, the thoughts of the people of the world.
But whoa, sometimes the only way to defeat a predator is to become one. Oh, that's Metroid Fusion. Pretty cool.
And, yeah, so it's a whole full-page spread of him looking like he's listening to headphones, but it's really all the people in his head. And then I like that he puts his mask on at some point.
Yep. He's like, I figured this out now. It's a clue, too. He's come to a conclusion.
That can't be good, Steve. Zemo coming to a conclusion?
Yep. But I love that ribbed... I mean, that's the Mike Zeck designed look from the, you know, DeMatteis and Zach Beatty run. Love it with the kind of the crown headpiece on around the Zemo with the ribbed, the purple mask with the ribs coming down. It's an awesome look.
So the whole point is he's going to convince Sunfire to sacrifice himself so that both worlds can live. So he's going to plug this end. But even if they plug this end, they still got to plug the 616 side end as well. It's not going to be over on this end. But first, they got to plug this end. The problem is, Jolt is going to act like kind of the anchor, but it's probably going to eat her up and use up all her bubble gum.
Thank God.
And that ain't going to be good, because then she's going to die. So the other team is going to go from the inside, where Atlas is going to throw his bubble gum into the void. And so the last second, when they're all pouring their energy in, the Fixer hits Jolt, who's outside their energy field, with a little zapper and says, so long, Squirt. And what happens is they all get passed through. The other Thunderbolts get passed through, but Jolt stays behind. And it worked. They plugged the hole. But where it ends is it ends with Zemo and Hawkeye in that face-off we saw before. And that way, if you want to compare the two different art teams, you have a nice way of doing it.
So the Young Allies are left on Counter-Earth, and Jolt is left on their... With them?
Yeah.
Yes, well,
that's just as good as dead.
Jumped
that ahead,
and that's leaked in the next issue.
Whoa.
But, yeah.
Well, you want Jolt dead again?
No, well, I'm sick. I didn't care for her too much.
I think the other important thing to mention is that during all this bubblegum madness, Eric and Dallas get separated here.
Yep, I see Dallas's butt, too.
Yeah, it's blurry, though.
And now it's not creepy because she's not in a wheelchair anymore.
She could be Steve, though. She's you don't know.
I do know.
That's because you read the other issue.
Well, and now that I'm going back and rereading it with you guys, I can look at her butt and say, hey, it's Dallas's butt. And not be freaked out about it.
Nothing wrong with cute girls in wheelchairs. We all had a crush on Barbara Gordon. But this leads us to issue the double size issue 75. Oh, none of these have had letter pages either, which is kind of annoying to me.
Well, I don't think you want a letter page in 75 telling everyone, hey, the Thunderbolts book is going to continue, but you won't recognize it.
Yep, and you don't want any letters going to the new editors. Don't want to be putting any letters of how people love the book because they're about to change it.
Because it's and this is back to Manuel Garcia and Scott Hanna, but it's still Fabian. And sure, something Steve noticed and wasn't happy to are our paper changes.
Yeah, I can't believe this book took so long. Like this must be like the last Marvel comic to go to glossy paper. Like the X-Men were doing that like 10 years previous. And then the other thing is that this cover, you like that they're blowing up the Thunderbolts, like the logo and everything you know about the Thunderbolts are just...
I like them blowing up this Thunderbolts logo. This one sucks.
Exactly.
The old Thunderbolts logo was cool. They needed on their belt buckles again.
And you know what's so funny too is the two Thunderbolts groups are looking at each other to start this issue, and in the background you can see Dallas covering up, but Atlas doesn't care. He's just walking around as Skin is like making them new fabric clothes.
He's even punching out his chest. Like, hey, yeah. Look at me, everybody, not bubblegum anymore. Look at this way.
Hey, it's
around.
Gotta be glad to actually have a human form, much like the Fixer, you know, when you get to turn human again, it's gotta be nice.
That's not a pack of gum in my pocket.
And I am happy to see you. But yeah, so the two teams, it's like devastation all around. And Hawkeye has his bow faced at Zemo, and Zemo actually pulls his pistol away. And he's going to explain how he's now a good guy, and he asks Carla to back him up. But, Hawkeye's, a little suspicious, as I think we all would be. I'm still suspicious, and I read the issue.
Well, shouldn't you be suspicious of Moonstone, too? She has two Moonstones.
Well, I don't think he notices that, but he goes on to something about Quip about his Zemo's outfit, something about the pink sock.
But isn't that weird? Because in the way the colors are in this issue, Zemo's mask is the same purple as Hawkeye's costume.
Which is redder than Citizen V's purple.
Well, you can't expect everything to be perfect.
But they still have a problem to solve with closing that hole on...
Right, because their hole... Earth. Yes. The other side has been closed, but this one isn't. So the two teams are pulling out and getting back together again. But guess who is on the V Battalion who might not like Baron Zemo?
Oh, Citizen V. No, just Citizen V, because he's like, you stole my body and all this stuff, and he thinks it's more important to settle a grudge than, save the Earth.
Well, he's a hothead, and he doesn't know that Zemo's a decent guy, but they all convince him, look. And this, and the mask is, like, tight-fitting. It's a leather. Zemo's mask is now, like, completely form-fitting to his face on the close-ups.
It's true.
And he has to admit, the ship's got to go, and they're not thrilled about it, but it's going to save the Earth.
But certainly the V Battalion, backed up their data, in multiple other places on Earth, so they're not really losing all their stuff anyways, right?
They got a whole bunch of tape drives out there somewhere.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, they're in Simcaria. They're in a friendly place. It's not like they can't have servers on the ground.
And speaking of Simcaria, Silver Sable makes an appearance after doing this. If you are a Silver Sable fan, you do not need to run these down if that's the only reason, because she hasn't been given a lot to do, and I haven't been impressed with what she has been given to do.
Well, she used the Crimson Cowl's cowl to move mass into that giant hole last issue.
Yeah, but her lame plan with the red to begin with facing off the Crimson Cowl. And then this is she's like, points the gun at Zemo, and Zemo points out, hey, I'm not the same Zemo. He pulls off the mask, and his face is not scarred.
Is it plastic surgery? Cloning?
Although none of these people must have read any of those Dan Slott ones where they talked about comic book precedent, because I'm sure they can prove the removed, changed bodies. But they do seal it, and they're going to let Zemo go. And after the Thunderbolts evaporate out, an escape, we get a little hint that, Jim, it's not a big deal. You want to tell him, John? My dear James Hammond, we've only lost everything that they know of. So you guys are right. They do have a backup.
See, Steve, it's okay.
Cool.
But you know what the weird thing is? The V Battalion, like, as soon as the Thunderbolts start disappearing, they open fire on them. I'm like, geez, what if it was just smoke or something? The bolt's going to go through that.
Well, you know, you got to make your shot when you can. You got to take your shot when you can. But in this instance, what I like is they end up going in. You know, we've seen some of the underbelly, sort of the criminal network, and this is more a part of it because Moonstone Carla knows that the safe house of Dr. Faustus, which is this cool, like, island paradise in the Canary Islands.
Wait a second. What you mean when they were with Hawkeye and they used Melissa's cabin and all that, you know, all that stuff? They could have been at this place instead?
Well, the Canary Islands are pretty far out. Like, if they were trying to run around and solve crimes and everything, it'd be a long commute.
I guess so.
Like, now they got the teleporting, so they can just hang out there and wait for them to get called.
Plus, Faustus was there. That was... He was using his timeshare at that time.
But they give a particular... They actually have Norbert's tongue hang out when...
He look like so cartoonish in that panel? And
I also imagine all of his sensors, all his sensor instruments, like just popped out too, like Transformers, just like sprong, because he sees skin naked. But you know what's interesting about the panel, though, honestly, is that they're really showing us that he's completely given into his humanity now, right?
Yeah, he's no longer the unemotional.
He's salivating at the sight of a naked girl. I mean, he's not robot Norbert anymore by any stretch.
But the rest of this is going to be just a cool, like, let's look at the characters. Who's who? And this is where I apologize. I spoiled it that Jolt was left back on Counter-Earth with the Young Allies. So they're going to take over and try and save Counter-Earth.
It looks like everyone's getting together on Earth, too. Like Eric and Dallas, Abe and Melissa.
Yeah, everyone's... But they got to figure out what they're doing. Like Amazon, Eric tries to have a heart-to-heart with her about joining the team, but she just isn't going to have any of it. She has outstanding warrants, and she just walks off like the Juggernaut crossing the ocean.
You know what ad looks really out of place in this comic is this, when your URL connects to a UFO, you're on the outer net. Did not age well.
Yeah.
Hey, speaking of UFO, did they mention what the deal was with why the Vanguard, is it called? The V Battalion's big ship? Why it's hyperdrive, or it's where they came from, and what the whole deal was to connect it to the big mystery from Counter-Earth?
I assume it has to do with that one ship was because of the other spaceship was in the middle of Counter-Earth.
Yes, that was the whole connection, is that they reverse-engineered a lot of that ship, including using the engine technology, and the actual engine cores are from our Earth's spaceship that was in the middle of the Earth. Like, when they found that one on Counter-Earth, they found a partially phased alien spaceship in the center of the Earth. They speculated that, I wonder if there's one on the real Earth, if this is an exact copy. And sure enough, now we know there was.
Yeah, and I wouldn't go investigating that link too. Like, I'm not sure the reasoning holds up much past your explanation, so let's maybe leave that thinking there. But
Andrew, some of the explaining you're having to do and making sense of some of that crazy stuff that you managed, I think a lot of belief is being suspended for this storyline.
You know who had a real rough time trying to summarize that for the Thunderbolts website?
2003, Kev.
Two, Kevin?
Yeah, that's why when someone else wrote a better summary, he put that up on the website, because he's just like, I don't really know what's going on. There are a lot of science mumbo-jumbo engines.
Yeah, but what were you, like 8 years old?
Exactly.
8 years old, but still has a website. But so after Amazon leaves, Dallas Reardon meets up with Eric, and she is not only walking again, but she has enhanced reflexes and strength. And does this whole flipping off of the top of a palm tree and double somersaults and everything. But Atlas is out of juice. And playing peeper creeper on all this is the Fixer. He's just watching it all.
I tell you.
So Atlas doesn't... get a spin-off book out of this?
Yeah, whatever happened.
Maybe the Fixer will.
I thought his brother got mad, and I guess something will happen to him eventually. But what, with Amazon, I thought that was funny that she just kind of walks off into the ocean and drowns herself.
She's swimming.
Oh,
sort of.
She has superpowers.
So she was just gonna walk into the ocean and try to like be like the Juggernaut and walk across the ocean.
Yeah,
and just
she's
drown.
Juggernauting it. Right. She's got the power.
And it's so weird. Like Fixer is describing all the people, and you see Carla just talking to Clint, but for like Abe and Melissa, all you see is a bed, and I'm like, ooh, okay, yeah, definitely creeper.
They missed each other. Yeah. So Zemo confronts the Fixer about what he's going to do, and the Fixer's really at a loss, and suddenly he just blasts off and leaves him. And so we cut to Hawkeye and Moonstone, who notice that, and Hawkeye doesn't know what his role is, and he's not sure how he's going to lead him, and Moonstone's like, maybe you don't need to lead him. And so what's going on with those two crazy kids?
I mean, for all these character pages that they're devoting to this character stuff and these character moments, they're adding up to not much. Like, as I'm, you know what I mean? As I'm reading each of these scenes, like, they're just saying a bunch of gobbledygook to each other and nobody's coming to any conclusion. Like, I was very unsatisfied when I'm reading through this. I'm like, yeah, nothing's going on, nothing's going on, nothing's going on. Do you kind of feel the same way?
I thought not was a lot, but I enjoyed the atmosphere. Like, I felt like, okay, I get what they're kind of, it's less character and almost more plot in a way, but I do feel like they're taking their time, but I do feel like we're going to see what happens with the Fixer has a bit of a change of heart, kind of. I think he goes through an element that we get to see.
But in by and large, these character scenes have been short and tight in the past and have been really revealing and interesting and mysterious and intriguing. And it's not just when it was Busick, too. Fabian was able to pull that off plenty of times. So this feels like a whole lot signifying not much.
I feel like they're also just continuing on, like they're going to do something with some of this stuff next issue. It's like they're not in any hurry, even though we know what's coming.
I think it's that mix of like they're trying to do the decompression style but also have character moments which don't work as well like they did in the old days. You still had character moments, so like Steve said, it's compact, it's efficient, it's tight.
They don't want to set up any mysteries here, that's for sure, because they're ending the issue. But did it really need to be a double size issue? I mean, a lot of this could have been, these scenes could have been tightened up, I think, quite a bit.
Well, at least Hawkeye still has his scar when he's talking to Moonstone.
Yes,
that might impress
you. I'm glad. And to this day, right?
No. Right. No, he got some plastic surgery done eventually, Steve.
So he could be in the movie.
Yeah. But yeah, it looks like Fixer's getting involved in real-world events here, going to another country and blowing up their chemical stock.
Not just another country, he goes to Iraq and finds their weapons of mass destruction and blows up a bunch and steals some.
And that seems somewhat ominous that they're doing it, because he flies off, but then Melissa and Abe are having a big fight, and that leads to her storming off, and at that point then, you know, Skeen's going to hit on her, because why not? And she's pretty miffed about that.
Melissa Abe, they haven't been the same since he went to jail. Honestly.
No.
Why do these kids keep trying?
Well, they went to, went to jail, and then, you know, Techno played the whole joke on him where you're now black, and it just hasn't been super well.
So, and then Skeen, that leads right into Plant Man, who, you know, now we're not calling Plant Man, but I'm still calling Plant Man.
Yeah.
He's going to be some knockoff derivative character. He doesn't deserve a new name. So the two of them are like trying to figure out. He's like, I'm in. And she's like, I don't know. So, you know, we already lost Amazon. Are we going to lose Skin as well? And Hawkeye and Zemo are having a face-off.
See, Rob Liefeld, jumps in. Rob Liefeld stepped in to draw that panel there of Zemo?
Yeah, Zemo has the most developed pecs this side of Rob Liefeld.
I mean, where's his? I mean, look at his collarbone and then where his ribs would be. I mean, that's like Elephant Man stuff going on there.
Yeah, well, but Moonstone uses her psychic ability to take them around sort of Scrooge style, like we're getting the ghost of Christmas past showing all the good things he did. Remember way back when he, although we don't get an editor's note, of course, because this editorial team's checked out, but where Zemo saved that mother and child. And even at the time, he's like, I don't know why I'm doing this, but now this is why he's doing it. So he can back it up.
You know, it's an even farther callback to, like, the teens of the book. When they go to Zemo's base here in Central America, there's, like, all these people using it. And then they're like, oh, why is Kevin Costner there? Isn't that one of the clones when Fixer was creating all those extra bodies for Zemo that he could have used, and one of them looked like Kevin Costner?
Yes.
Like, that's a long-running subplot. Like, that's so long. Like, that's the one that got out that escaped his tube and everything and is now just walking around.
So, the whole point is that Zemo's a new guy and he's reformed, and Hawkeye is, he's not having it, but Moonstone tries to convince him. And then Hawkeye's mad because she never said, I love you. And then she gets mad because she's like, all the stuff I've been doing just to live up to your image. And so she flies off angry. He's like, but you still haven't said I love you.
She loves him, though.
Yeah, I think by her actions.
We'll find out by the end of the issue, right?
Right. And is Zemo's going up the stairs with his purple mask on, or pink, or magenta. And Dallas and Atlas are coming down. And suddenly, dun-dun-dun, guess who shows up? But the Fixer, and blasts him.
What?
Oh, no.
And he blasts him and turns him back into Atlas. And he explains that that's how no one could find the weapons of mass destruction, because he had some Pym particles that he was hiding, and that's what he stole back and hit him with Pym particles. And he gets a joke in about the size of Atlas's equipment.
Well, do you have naked Atlas roaming the countryside here?
Yeah, and we already know he doesn't mind waving it around.
So, you know, the Fixer's like, look, I can do this. I just got to do it on my own terms. You know, he's free to be a jerk and a half, but he's going to solve problems.
And we finally find out why Abe and Melissa were fighting. Abe's going back to jail.
What?
Woo-hoo. Back to jail.
I'm so shocked I'm going to put the same panel in exactly twice.
Yeah.
I remember that was a staple in the 90s.
I mean, that's pretty bad, though. I mean, geez, it's two big, giant panels in the middle of the page that are exactly the same.
Do you remember some, like, Green Goblin comics by, like, Sal Buscema when he drew the Green Goblin in, like, some kind of straitjacket, like, nine times in a row?
But that's kind of how him and DeMatteis did those weird drama character-y things, like with the Vermin and... You know, they did a lot of cinematic break down the panels into seconds and do scenes that way, usually without dialogue on those scenes, too. So you would really get the sense that it's happening. The moment that you're looking at is actually fast, even though it's broken up into all those panels to really make you look at that face. I hear you. But here I thought egregious.
Well, then what's odd, so they're fighting about that, and... There's, like, the ghost of the old bald guy with his arms crossed to him, like, wait, which one is that?
Who is that supposed to be, exactly?
Puck.
Is that Harrier?
I thought that's Puck from Alpha Flight. No? Too tall, I guess.
So he's like, I gotta go when anyone else can come with me, and that's when he puts his armor on, and he's like, I gotta go. And Sentry backs him up and says, you know what, I got scammed by the Crimson Cowl. But I don't want to be hunted down, and it's the right thing. So he shakes hands with Hawkeye. So he didn't fall for the extremely non-believable, tenuous reasoning given to him before.
So this launches another series on top of the other one, right? Where Abe and Harrier have a series inside the prison?
With their armors.
Yeah.
Flying around in their cell.
But at this point, the Fixer hands a little pill to... Mach 5, and I like how you pointed out we skipped Mach 4 entirely for some reason.
I know, I was reading this, I'm like, yeah, that doesn't... Wait, what?
Isn't Carrier Mach 4?
I don't. It just ended up skip. But that's so they decide, and you know they're gonna head back to jail and do what they got to do. So they're off the table. But he, you know, has nice words for Melissa. And then after that, Hawkeye's like, "Yes, it's time for me to go."
Yeah,
you know.
And he says Melissa's the only one that's gonna make the right decision, and she's gonna become a hero. Well, he was right there. She's a hero.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I like how he calls Zemo, "I gotta give New Coke Zemo a chance."
Yes.
I did like that. A little, got to get your jabs in when you can. But he's like, the point is, you know, this all was about giving you guys a chance, and you guys earned it. You showed you're good guys, so go out there and do the right thing. And if not, you know, the Avengers and I will hunt you down. Although we all know that he burned up his Avengers card, but that's a lot of hooey.
And it looks like Moonstone and Hawkeye had some time together as she dropped him off in Washington, D.C.,
at least that's where she said she dropped him off. Could have been in the middle of the ocean.
Oh, yeah. It could have been.
Well, she was going to drop him off at a plastic surgeon to fix the scar.
There you go.
So, yeah, I can work this stuff out so we cure up some of these continuity issues.
And she burnt and out one of the two moonstones to fix him. Like, that would really put all the pieces back right where they started.
Oh, I don't know if you want to do that one, Steve.
It used up one of my moonstones entirely to fix your lip.
And then in one of the least convincing turns, this one came out of nowhere. Like, I was fine up until now, but this suddenly, they all show up, and we're dropping off DC. So was he convinced? Yeah, he doesn't suspect a thing. That's Zemo and Carla.
Yeah, so who's left standing here? Who's he talking to? It's Zemo, Carla... It's the Fixer, it's Atlas and Dallas, it's Plant Man, and Songbird. They're all that's left.
Yeah. Too many of the others would have proven difficult to convince. They would have not agreed that we have the best interests of the world at heart. That in order to save this planet, we will have to rule it.
Dun, dun, dun.
And I was like, what? Like, first of all, Plant Man and Songbird weren't even on this team, like, when you were ruling Counter-Earth. Like, where did this plan come from? Like, where? What? I was really... this just was, like, felt super tacked on to me.
Yeah, I mean...
And it, not justified in the story.
Well,
beats
Zemo
anywhere.
Will always be Zemo. But you
but
know what it was?
New Zemo.
It was the moment he connected with all the people on Counter-Earth mentally and then put on his mask right afterwards. That's when he decided.
I don't know. I felt like... First of all, I don't know why Plant and some of these other people are going along that weren't there at that moment. Like the two, Songbird and Plant Man seem to be the two.
Songbird's like, always been there to keep them in check, except for that one time or two when she stole some stuff. But
well, I'm glad it worked for you, Steve. It did not work for me. I'm not outraged and throwing my issue in the garbage or anything, but I'm not super thrilled. I wish they would have laid a few more seeds or something in there.
But you know, it's never the end, Andrew. And you might be throwing your issue next time.
Well, next time. Yeah, that's the other thing is like, no, it gives us a preview of Hulk number 50. Like, no letters page or comments or Stan's soapbox or Joe Quesada telling us things or anything.
This is what you get from the new editorial office.
Yeah, no,
Steve, it's never the end. It says it right here.
It's so the end that I'll be back for New Thunderbolts. Now, call me
New Coke Zemo?
Call me when Zemo and Songbird and Moonstone have a story told about them again.
That'll be Steve's ship, I guess. The New Thunderbolts.
You're not willing to reread those?
No, I'll reread those. But I don't feel like Thunderbolts is like it's New Thunderbolts.
Yeah.
We just concluded basically my Thunderbolts.
But they never finish talking about what's going on with Moonstone and the two stones. They're just left, that's just done?
No, you gotta keep reading, Steve. You gotta keep reading.
Well, I thought you said the Thunderbolts are done.
No, it's never the end.
Never the end.
All right.
It's never the end.
Cool. Which seems a little confusing, I'll be honest with you, Super Steve. I'm in the same boat you are, but... Yeah, so for those of you that don't know, Kevin sometimes contemporaneously when these issues came out kept his own record. So we like to peer back in on 2002 or 2003 Kevin and current Kevin and him battle it out. So what have we got from the old Kevin?
Yeah, even sometimes Steve defends the old Kevin. Or the younger Kevin. You know what I mean.
Yeah, I like him.
One of these Thunderbolts issues literally said on the next issue thing, like, we're through the looking glass. And I'm like, oh, Andrew, that's what you said. He had no summary for this issue for his website, only long, long thoughts. So he anticipated 75 with a certain amount of dread.
See? Me too.
After every comment, you should just say if you agree or disagree, Steve.
I will.
He says the last year of the book hasn't been the best, but 74 was looking up.
Eh.
75 was a fairly good issue, he says, but it was hampered by the art.
Well, got half of that right.
Jolt was never one of his favorite characters, so leaving her on Counter-Earth where she's not likely to show up anytime soon is perfectly fine.
You see why I like 2003, Kev? That makes sense.
Abe going back to prison was unexpected, but maybe in the future he can team up with Spider-Man when he gets out.
Boy, that seems unlikely.
As the new Beetle.
Since there wasn't much to clear up from the last issue, you know, it was good they had a lot of time to do that character stuff, since that's what the book was best for, and, you know, it was always a strong component.
It just wasn't done as good as in the past. Just wasn't as meaningful, those scenes. They had
them. Well, that's why it wasn't a great issue, no, only a fairly good issue. He actually he goes into greater depth on some of these issues he didn't cover, and he says how they were sort of, like, fairly average at times and stuff like that.
Agreed.
He's wondering about the credibility of certain teammates, like, if they want to save the world by ruling it. He's just like, well, how would Plant Man and Songbird link up and everything? He says there should be another issue to help clear this up, or a one-shot at least some point in the future.
All right, I think he'll get it.
He never trusted Zemo leading them on Counter-Earth.
Him and me both.
He's glad the team didn't break up and dissolve at the end, so it's easier for them to show up in another book again.
I guess that was planned.
So you knew it was ending then, back then?
Oh yeah.
You definitely knew. There was previews and everything.
Yep. Fight Club was coming.
Yeah. He had concerns about the Thunderbolts title. Like, even though it's cool that the team didn't dissolve, it's risky to not break them up and put this kind of an ending on the book, because the next writer can come along and just totally make them villains again and, like, erase everything that was there. And it's basically just the last couple of pages that does some of this stuff. So he's just like, Songbird turned the corner. Like, what if the next writer, you know, doesn't see the same things?
Let's just hope that the book goes to another editor's office when they get back to those characters.
That would be good. He was disappointed this will be the last time he gets to read these characters ever. The book was going great, and then it faltered, and then they had all those fill-in artists that didn't help either.
Totally agreed, and I think that's, again, points to the going to the new editorial office. But, hey, at least he got to reread these again, right? If only you could tell your old self that, don't worry, it'll be okay.
Yeah, how often do you, like, see a book get canceled, turned into something else, and then 6 months after that, it's back and has a long run? Like, that almost never happens.
Well, 75 issues is a long run, too, by the way. That ain't nothing.
Yeah, that's a great run. If any character you love can have a 75-issue run, that's a great run. He's on board for issue 76, and for the foreseeable future, that promises something different. But if you can't read about these characters, the story quality better be good in this title with the different characters.
Yeah. I took this right off my pull list. I was not going to be reading New Thunderbolts or the Fight Club Thunderbolts.
Oh, I think part of it was how everyone said the book was going to be terrible. So then he's just like, well, I want to be like those crazy, hasty Marvel fans that just react to everything without reading the issue. So he was like, I'm going to read the Thunderbolts.
Well, good.
I don't think he would have lasted much beyond the six issues that went, though.
So I think we've, yeah, I think my thoughts on this is it went out a bit on a whimper.
Yep.
Yeah.
Like, I think there were some really strong, and 75 issues plus all those tie-ins and everything else, it's been pretty good, but I just would have hoped they would have went out on something a bit stronger than what they went out on.
Like an explosion on the cover.
Boys, do you have any thoughts? I mean, we're not, believe me, this segment isn't ending. I bought a whole bunch of these issues, so. But.
Yeah. I think everyone knows that you bought 100 issues of Thunderbolts, so we still have 31 issues to get to 100. But I still felt something, like reading 75, knowing that this was the end of this specific era. I'm like, oh, man. Like, you think of what could have been, does happen, where things could have went, and all that, what was, and I'm just like, oh, man. Like, it's an end of an era.
I realize that this book really ended about 10 issues previous.
Well, you know what 2002 Kevin says? He says the good great ending point is sort of just before the bi-weeklies. Like, you had the Graviton stuff.
Agreed.
That Songbird solo issue, and then after that it sort of slowly descends.
Yep. But it was fun to reread with you guys.
Yeah, I'm excited. If we may not have Steve, for he may be taking a hiatus or not, I don't know, but Kevin and I will be returning, hopefully.
You think he was joking?
Yeah, no, call me when we're going to do Zemo and Melissa and Carla again.
But I'll be back, and Kevin will be back, and thanks for taking time to listen to us on this edition of Thunderbolts, Marvel's Most Wanted, bolting our thunder.
Justice like lightning.
Much later. We'll be right back.